Last time we talked, I think we ended our discussion on trying to level out the, like, really understand and put into context the state of Apple's software and push back against the notion that Apple's really buggy these days and that it's different than anything in the past. And, you know, shortly after that episode was released, there was a really unfortunate bug
we had another big bug because we ended the last show basically on the back of the macOS root security problem.
Yes.
And then the day after the last show, we had the what I'm calling Dategate.
Yeah. So last Wednesday, there was root, which we detailed last week. And then we record on Thursday. We release on Friday, generally. And on Friday night, maybe around like 8 p.m. or so, someone, you could see this happening on Twitter. You could see people in Australia and New Zealand, around the world, seeing this happen, and it seemed to be the date changing that was causing this to happen, which was their iPhones were crashing. You know, Springboard, the home screen was you know, crashing, and so their iPhones were like rebooting and
yeah, at midnight on December 2nd, basically. So not December 1st, on as soon as December 2nd rolled earlier, people's phones started crashing.
Yeah, and not good. Not a good time for that to happen, and that was a serious bug. That is not the kind of thing that is like the thing that happened with like autocorrect, you know, like the I turning into a question mark, you know, and an A. That's silly and unfortunate, and but it's not like this where things stopped functioning.
Yeah, and it appears to be something to do with the like internal notification code, and specifically local notifications were the cause, in that if you had apps installed that had repeating monthly local notifications, you'd be affected by this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't, then you weren't. So it wasn't like everyone's phones in the world were, but a reasonable number of people have apps that do this. Like a lot of like sleep trackers remind you to go to sleep, not by sending a notification from like an external server. They just have it on their own device where like every night at 10 p.m. or whatever, it sends you a local alert. And or another big app kind of category, this is like meditation apps that remind you to meditate at least like once a day and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they set like timers and alerts, and rather than the developers of those apps maintaining their own server infrastructure for information that's only ever local to your phone, they just do it locally. And this is an API that was introduced way back with iOS 4, back with the original multitasking. One of the kind of ways they let you do it with these kind of like local just timers and stuff, because before that the only way you could do it was from a server, but it didn't really make sense. If you were just making like an alternative stopwatch app or time or countdown app, why do you need a server just to let the person, you know, expire their countdown? The problem is, from a user perspective, it's hard to, almost impossible to tell, right? Like,
yeah,
you can't look at a notification, it doesn't say this is from a server, this is from, you know, generated by the app on your device. So being able to say if you were going to be affected by this was basically not possible. And you just have to hope that you got past 12:15 on December 2nd and your phone didn't stop restarting. And it wasn't like a full reset, it was just like Springboard repeatedly crashing because the local notification progress, there was some problem in the calendaring logic, and it would just like spin and spin and spin, use up more and more memory until it, you know, filled up the whole RAM, and then the whole of Springboard would go down, you'd see the black spinner, and then you'd be back at Springboard and you have to start all over again. So that's kind of like what the bug was.
Mm-hmm. There is an app I use called Close Up that is, it's like a selfie app. And the reason I use it is because you can take a photo. It'll remind you. You can optionally have a reminder to take a photo every day. And it has some really cool effects where you can see like your progress over time. And so whenever I started losing weight, I was using this long before that, but then I could see like over the span of a year, like my face literally changing dramatically in like a 60-second GIF. And I think it's a really cool app. And I don't use it as much anymore, but I still have the alert turned on to remind me every day at noon to use the app. And I think that would have been, you know, that's in that category of, it's not an internet-based alert, but it's a just like local time-based alert, right? Where that would have been enough to crash it?
Yeah, probably. It depends slightly on how the notification is configured, but most of them did cause this.
Right.
If you see what I mean?
Yeah. The thing is, I don't think I would have been affected because I was on iOS 11.2 beta, and that I think it came out pretty early on that was not affected. You could see from people on the beta, zero people were saying it was happening, and then people on the official release of iOS were experiencing the issue. And I mean, this is one of the things really cool about Twitter was it was neat to see, like, from, you know, living in the US perspective, like hours ahead of time, kind of see something that was coming your way, and there was plenty of time to
the oncoming storm,
right? Exactly. And the expertise of people like diagnosing the problem before it ever got to the US. So you, like, before I went to bed that night, like, I knew what the problem was, and like was kind of bracing myself for in the morning, like, you know, hearing from family about what's going on, and I could tell them the solution. It was tricky, right? It was some people were saying change the date on your phone, which is dangerous because that can mess up a lot of other things like iMessage.
Yeah, the problem is if you change it back a day, mm-hmm. then it would A, work for another 24 hours, yeah. because at that time we didn't know how long it was going to be until Apple had a fix out, right?
Yeah.
So if you went back to December 1st and then in the real world it was now December 3rd, well, you're going to add another 24 hours back on, you're going to have the same problem. Just, you know, you're just delaying it a few mm-hmm. hours. Plus, if you change the date back, a lot of like server encryption stuff relies on the timestamp to be accurate, to be able to communicate. So
right.
Sometimes if you change the date back, services just stop responding. So it's not a great option. The better solution was to disable notifications from every single app on your phone.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's no like one button to say don't do alerts. I wish there was.
There used to be, right? In an older version of iOS, in the notification yes. settings at the top, it would just be allow notifications. You could turn them all off at once, but yes. they got rid of that at some point.
Yeah, I wish they had one for badges, because I would disable every badge. Like, the first thing I do when I install an app is like disable the badge, because I hate badges. They're not useful anymore, except for like very limited situations. Because if you have too many, they're meaningless. So you need to have very few for them to have any meaning at all. Yeah. It was like delete. I guess you could maybe like remove the app if you wanted to, but otherwise it was disable all your alerts.
Yeah, and which isn't a great option anyway, yeah, right? Like yeah. if you have 100 apps installed, quite a lot of those apps nowadays have some form of notification, and you couldn't just disable the local ones because you don't know which is local and which is server side. So you'd have to turn them all off, or just go down the list and turn them off until your phone stopped restarting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the big problem here was when Apple did release the fix, which they did pretty promptly, right? Like about 10 hours later, 12 hours later, mm-hmm. what they did is they just released iOS 11.2 prematurely. Like, it was supposed to come out on about Monday and they pushed it out on a Saturday. And that's the first time ever they've done an iOS update on a weekend, which kind of just shows the significance of this problem. Like, you have to have a really bad problem to get the engineering team back up and working on a weekend, just because, you know, most people take, you know, they don't work weekends. Like, that's like disaster mode only.
Yeah. 11:45 p.m. local is essential time. I tweeted out 11.2 is done and expected Monday, so maybe just push that out since it's fixed. And let's see, the first reply was at 2:30 a.m. my time. Someone said they heard you, so
yeah, you were the prophet.
I mean, it made sense. Like, I kind of said it like jokingly, just thinking that they wouldn't actually do that because it's Apple and they're going to stick to their schedule. But it made sense because like that version was beta 6 from that very day, and that was the first version without the feedback app in it, I think. And it was like the big version, like big in gigabytes wise. And so it's quite like that was going to be the version that they released. So it made sense to push it out. Now,
yeah, it wasn't like it was beta 1,
right?
Unstable form. Everyone that I've been seeing over the last like 2 months that this version's been in beta anyway has been saying how stable and good it is. Because I've been running the public versions on my iPhone 10 just to be fun for a while, just to be off the beta life, just
sure,
have
yeah.
a bit of a refresher. But it wasn't like 11.2 was the first version. It wasn't like people saying it's unstable. The beta 6 that was released on that Friday was 99% going to be the build that was pushed out on the Monday anyway.
Yeah, unless it had like a date bug in it, it was going to be the one.
Yeah, so pushing it forward, you know, at the end of the day, it did cause some annoyances because like they pushed it out so fast they hadn't updated the release note, so it said like this update includes Apple Pay Cash, but obviously Apple Cash wasn't supposed to rolling out to the Monday, so everyone was asking where's Apple Pay Cash as soon as they installed it. And they even said that for international things, it didn't even say US only at the beginning. Later they updated the release notes to put brackets US only on it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of confusion around that, both domestically and internationally. It also came out, you know, out of sync with like the other updates of, you know, the other big platform updates.
Yeah.
And there was a big problem with like Xcode. The new Xcode wasn't out before that one was ready, so if you updated your phone you couldn't debug on that version. On the public Xcode you had to go to the beta. Like, there was a lot of a lot of inconsistency just because they couldn't push everything out at the same time because they pushed 11.2 forward. Mm-hmm. But that has to be the right option, right? They need to do whatever they could to get this fix out as soon as possible, because people would be queuing at Apple stores, queuing at the Genius Bar, queuing on the Apple support care phone line. And they need, you know, those support reps need an answer. Like, the you could look at the Apple support Twitter over that weekend. It was just slammed. Everyone, like, you know, every single tweet was about, oh, disable notifications and update, disable notifications and update. Because one of the big problems with this particular fix was you couldn't just go to the software update and install it, because if you're affected by this problem, the likelihood is while it was downloading, you'd crash, and then you have to start downloading it again. So, you know, you had to do the notification, disable the notifications before you did the update, which is annoying. But it's not like if they'd have waited 4 days to do, you know, iOS 11.1.1.3, it wasn't like that was going to mean they weren't going to have to do that. Like, all their customers are still going to have to deal with the problem and disable notifications for that period of time. So this was clearly, to me, like the obvious solution. In general, you know, development pipelines and stuff, you don't want to push stuff ahead of where you should, because, you know, you do take risks. And like, one thing we saw was Face ID stopped working, for instance, for people on iPhone 10 until you rebooted. Like, and apparently that was only affecting people that had put their date back. Like, if the date changed and you updated, then it would disable the Face ID stuff. So, and luckily the fix for that was just rebooting. It didn't affect the hardware permanently or anything. But, you know, there's little niggles and weirdness, especially around Apple Pay Cash and the updates for the other platforms, that just, you don't want to make a habit, I think, of doing, you know, pushing forward these updates. It's like having a hit of sugar. You know, you can do it a couple of times and you get away with it. But if it was like a systematic, oh, every single time we're having such big problems, we've got to push forward these updates, you know, urgently, then you start like collecting technical debt and you start just piling, you know, hacky workarounds on top of workarounds. So for a one-off thing, you know, it's all right, but you don't want this to become a trend, really.
Yeah, I mean, I saw some fairly technical people confused about why the release that said Apple Pay Cash for people in the U.S., and then not know why it wasn't there. And that was further complicated by the fact that if you were on the public or developer beta, you had Apple Pay Cash. So at that point, iOS 11.2 was out, and some people were on it from the beta, which was now the live version, and some people were on the live version not from the beta. And if you're on the beta, you had Apple Pay Cash. If you didn't, you didn't. And the reason for that was Apple Pay Cash was pushed over the air during the beta process without a new build. And so because this was pushed out early, even though it was in the release notes, you know, which were prepared hastily and not actually, like, I guess, edited until later on, they still held Apple Pay Cash until like when it was planned to go. Like, I think it went out on Monday, and then they had like an official, you know, like Apple Newsroom post about it on Tuesday. So, you know, again, that was confusing to people, but this was totally the right call to make, because it was a bad bug on a bad week to have a bad bug, and going the whole weekend without fixing it when there was a fix ready to go was not good. Like, I saw people updating to the public beta for the first time just so they can get the fix, and that would be so complicated for most people to do, you know?
Yeah. And by the way, 11.2 has a lot of fixes in it that we didn't even know about, right?
Like, yes.
There's stuff for keyboard responsiveness. It has the calculator bug where, you know, the animation meant that you couldn't type in numbers fast. It has all sorts of stuff. And there's, in our post, you can see like the full release notes. There's like 20 different bullet points of random fixes. And most of these are things that have been obviously affecting people, but not enough that we've posted about them before. So, but it is good in that regard that Apple is, you know, fixing stuff. And in general, I think people are saying 11.2 is pretty stable in, like, overall. On my phone, it feels very good, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the point where, you know, this has been iOS 11 has been being developed since over the summer, and then we've had, you know, this is the time of the year, I guess, that if you're skeptical of upgrading, like, this would be the time to do that. Then, you know, this is when we expect it to start happening, because it won't be long, and then you know, development for the next version starts. So
yeah, you get 0.3, which will have HomePod and stuff in it now. Sure. And then that'll probably be the last big release, right?
I would imagine
they don't normally do 0.4s, because by June they're back on the iOS 12 beta cycle.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. I think there was like 8.4 for Apple Music, because that was the timing of that release. But that's kind of an exception. So yeah, you know, it was actually kind of weird, like, seeing the updates go out throughout the week, because even though iOS 11.2 came out early, they still didn't do TVOS at the same time as watchOS and macOS. So there was some time even between Apple Pay Cash coming live for everyone on 11.2 that it still wasn't in watchOS yet for everybody, unless they were in the developer beta, because that did need a new version to work. I think, you know, Monday afternoon, Tuesday morning, everyone in the U.S. gets Apple Pay Cash. And so that's finally live. We talked about that, you know, over the fall. And now it's available for everyone to actually use. I've not yet used it in a real life scenario that is not just like testing it still, like with even more people. But it's there. And I imagine that the more, like, the thing I use Square Cash for is with family. And whenever they start to have actually update, and there's a need to send cash one way or the other, it'll be super cool to do that, you know. And then you're in the UK, and
we're
no
in the
up.
UK, so yeah, no gracias here. Like, hopefully it expands to more countries, but it took like at least a year for the normal Apple Pay to come across the pond. So
that's true.
I hope it comes soon. I think it's a cool feature, like especially the integration with. You know, if someone types a dollar amount in the message and you can just tap and reply, like, I don't see a big motivation to have a third party send payments to other people app installed, as long as you're just talking to iOS people. If you, like, obviously there's no solution for Android, and maybe eventually they do like an Apple Pay Cash app on Android just to serve that market, because it kind of benefits them. But like, why would you bother to use like Venmo and stuff to send money to people, really? Like, if you can just do it from within messages.
Yeah, even for Android, I imagine they would never do that, because I think it's only available on devices with Apple Pay, and that's because it goes to the virtual debit card, and then that relies on the secure enclave.
Yeah, I mean, for Android, they could do just not doing the, you know, in-person merchant payments. Like, you could just have, like, a bank, you know, a virtual bank account.
Transfer,
you send,
sure, yeah.
You top up money and you give it to other people, and then you can send it back to your real bank account. Like, obviously, a big appeal of the current, of the iOS way, is that you have, like, an Apple Pay virtual card that you can just walk up to a retailer and spend, you know, in the real world with. Mm-hmm. But if you just want, a lot of people just, you know, send money to their friend and they just put it back into their bank. So maybe that's a reason for them to put like an Apple Pay Cash on there eventually.
Yeah, I wonder about. So you can't answer this, even though you have a MacBook Pro with Touch Bar, but you can't answer this because you don't have Apple Pay Cash in the UK. But if you're in the US with a MacBook Pro with Touch Bar, which can do Apple Pay, I wonder if you're able to use that at the Apple Pay Cash card as your card that you pay with on the Mac. Like, I've used Apple Pay Cash on my Mac. Because you can, like, even without a Touch Bar, you know, which has the Apple Pay function with Touch ID, you can use a nearby iPhone or Apple Watch to verify the payment, and it goes through that. So in that case, it's one of the options because it's on those devices. But I wonder if it's possible in the Mac without, you know, with Touch Bar, where you're doing it directly on the device.
Yeah, I bet it's not possible at the moment.
I'd be curious. So if you know, you know, let us know. I'm curious.
Because also, you can't, like, do Apple Pay Cash on the Messages app on the Mac anyway, right? Like, it's iOS and watchOS only.
Yeah, there's a fun bug where on the iPhone it's handled properly, where you can't do Messages effects, you know, like the slam and the glitter stuff, you know, disco balls and all that from the iPhone with Apple Pay Cash. But on the iPad, I don't think they've disabled it like they need to. And so you can send Apple Pay Cash, you know, and you know, you send like a message that's contextual, so it has the same like black UI as Apple Pay Cash. You can add an effect to that, and so then you can send like disco and lasers. but if you do the invisible text one where it does like the glittery snow over it,
invisible ink.
Yeah, invisible ink. It doesn't work. Like, it sends, but you can't erase like the ink because it's not supposed to work. And so on the Mac, it's just like botched because it never looks good anyway. And then on the iPhone and iPad, you can't erase it. It's just like a weird blob on your screen. And so I think the fix there is just like just turn that off on the iPad, you know, in like a future update. But it's kind of neat that you can do that now because you're not supposed to.
I do wonder if Apple Pay Cash will start seeing like abuse, like if random bots just start requesting money from random people in the hope that someone presses yes and then they just get a couple of dollars. Like, I haven't still seen ways that would be, you know, not happen. Like, I could just spam somebody with $1, $1, $1, please give me $1, $1, $1. And then, you know, on the off chance, they say, yes, oh, I've made some money. And if you automate that, you know, mechanically, you could you know, make a decent amount of money.
Yeah. We saw there was some new documentation on Apple Pay Cash whenever the feature actually went live. And I think there's like a lifetime limit of $20,000 per account. Like, I think that's the most you can have in your account at any time. You know, maybe you can.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. And I assume if you really spam it, then they might like flag your credit card and stuff and like cancel it.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, it's still like the Discover card in the background. And then I think, what is it called? Green Dot Bank. So
yeah.
It isn't like it's just like Apple making their own bank from scratch. You know, they're tying their service onto existing, you know, structures. So
they're letting others bear the risk, really.
Sure. Yeah. So like, I'm not even sure if, you know, I've heard it discussed elsewhere that Apple gets interest from the money that you're letting sit in their Apple Pay Cash, you know, but I'm not sure that's even true, right? Because they're...
I believe that's all handled by Green Dot.
Me too. Like, I don't imagine Apple. Like, I think there's fees from Apple transactions, and then there's the 3% fee from the credit card. You know, if you send cash with a credit card, there's a 3% fee, which is like the industry standard. But maybe Apple gets a cut of that. But I doubt they get anything from your balance. Maybe, but
yeah, I was talking to somebody, and they believe that Apple Pay Cash will cost Apple money overall.
Yeah,
like, it'll be a loss leader.
Like, yeah, exactly. So it's a reason to use Apple Pay in stores, which they do get a percentage of. Like, it's like less than a penny.
Yeah, it might offset it out a bit. So like the revenue they get from normal Apple Pay can pay for this Apple Pay Cash feature.
Yeah, but really,
and obviously Apple Pay Cash is like a feature for the platform. So you buy more iPhones and iPads, and you know enmesh into the ecosystem more.
Yeah, and you don't use Square and Venmo and PayPal. You know. I think PayPal might be the biggest one there. It's like you instead of using PayPal to send money, you use this, and so that keeps you off of the competitors. Even though you can use this on iOS, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's also just convenient. Like, if you're trying to build tools for your customers, this is a good one to have. You know, and hopefully you get it soon because it's cool. Also, let's talk about my new house just for a moment. I mostly moved in. I'm barely unpacked, but I am in the new location. I'm really happy, so that's good.
Well, that's a good sign.
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges with moving HomeKit, which is kind of something we discussed last week. The thing that's confusing to me is a couple of things here. So the lights in this home, there's like two switches for every light for the most part. Like, if you can enter a room from left and right, then there's a switch on either side. And that's convenient for in terms of like entering the room and not walking into the dark, but it drives me crazy because there's no like I think this is standard: up is on, down is off. But because there's two switches, they're not in sync, and so you never know from looking at it. And I'm not even sure, like, I haven't mapped out quite yet what switch goes to what, because there's like it's not very well considered. And so for that reason, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with like the HomeKit situation, because that's a complication I didn't have before. Before, it was like one switch per light, and it was pretty straightforward. And now it's a new challenge. It's like, if I do the Lutron stuff, then do I ignore a switch or like try to get people not to use them? Or
you could cover them up. You can get like the faceplates that just blank over the top of them.
Yeah, my plan was Lutron every switch possible, and then use the Philips dimmer switches with like a faceplate under it, so I'm not even like putting glue on a wall, but I'm you know, changing out a faceplate for like a dollar and then putting that on top of it, so there's no issue there. But when there's two, then I guess I'm like making one like a dead switch and then covering it up, and then the other one doing the same thing and covering it up but putting the switch on. I guess it's possible, but it's gonna be a lot more work than I anticipated. And so at this point, I'm barely like back in the HomeKit thing, and I do have a garage now. I have all the hardware to make the garage HomeKit compatible, but I haven't finished it yet because like I needed to look more into it. But it's like a Chamberlain garage door opener, and I've got the old bridge and the new bridge that's HomeKit compatible, and so far I haven't gotten it to work yet. There's like a process there's a step in the process. So it's like press the learn more button and wait, and I'm doing that and nothing's happening. And so I don't know what's next. So, you know, to be continued there. Also, something I want to mention is that in my new office environment, I've made a gigantic improvement in my work setup, which is, you know, I've been using the 5K iMac and the LG 5K display side by side. And before, in my old workspace, it was the iMac on the left and the LG display on the right. And the problem with that for me is that I use Hot Corners, which is a macOS feature where you can mouse to the extreme corner to activate an action like Screensaver or Show Desktop or Notification Center. And so I use the bottom right corner for Show Desktop. So if I have a lot of windows in the way, I can do that. And then I can see my desktop and like drag files, you know, get to them. And I use the top right corner to open Notification Center. But in the old arrangement, it wasn't the corner of the iMac because it was the left screen. That was like the middle of macOS. It was the corner of the LG display. So it was like way over here. I got to drag the cursor where I might not even be working. And so I rarely use Hot Corners in the left side of my Mac. So I think I might even have those set to anything, like maybe Screensaver and Sleep, but I don't use them very often. And so in my new arrangement, I've got the iMac on the right and the display on the left, and that has made such a it's way better for me because I can use my Hot Corners again and actually use Control Center, Notification Center. Because otherwise, like, you're clicking it and waiting, and it's slow. And the Hot Corner is just so much better than the other way. And also, like, do you use multiple displays?
Yeah, so I just have my laptop and then one external display that's stacked above it. Above it.
Okay. The way that it looks best visually, like whenever you're like showing it off, I think, and I see it like this in a lot of workspaces, is side by side, like literally side by side, you know, facing.
My current setup is like a hack, but
yeah,
it's the best of the situation at the moment. But yeah, normally it's like side by side is preferable.
Yeah, I mean that looks the best, but for me, like, I'm just like it's too big, like 27 inches and 27 inches at 5K resolution is like. I would need to like switch chairs or go back and forth. So, or it's like maybe sit in the middle. I don't know. It wouldn't be good. But so I've got the iMac like directly in front of me. And then to my left is the LG display. And that one, it's not like a right angle, but it's not side by side either. It's like kind of in the middle of that. And, yeah. And so it kind of makes like a circle sort of. And it's, I love it. Like I'm really enjoying this setup and this arrangement. And I don't know that I could go back. Like I work from the 12-inch MacBook sometimes, like when I'm traveling or like you know, having lunch or getting around. And I can do that. But like this is great. I'm really happy with this.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of having one, you know, at least one external display, mm-hmm. and then the internal one, which obviously in the iMac is its own big display.
Yeah.
The horizontal stack, the vertical stacking that I have is kind of good for the, you know, you're saying you don't see the stuff at the wide angles because it's all in your vision. You just kind of have to glance up and down.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look very pretty, which is the downside to it. But yeah. In terms of like function, it works pretty well because I have it like on a step. So my keyboard go in front of it and then the laptop screen's a bit higher and then the external display's above that.
Yeah.
So it works out pretty well. I still have problems long-term. Happy Hour listeners will know when we talked about multiple displays like last year. Yeah. I still have issues with like how macOS just like handles it with, or how the apps handle it, where windows appear like where you don't expect them to. And it's like you start a new document and then for some reason it starts in the screen and it takes you a while to even like find your place again. Like that stuff's still annoying. But once you have like everything open and ready to go, it feels, you know, you have a lot more power and just productivity.
Right, yeah. And they've made some improvements in macOS, I think, since our original discussion on how the dock moves and the menu bar is in focus and what, you know, what all that means. And my use is like my iMac is the main workspace. And then a lot of times if I'm writing, I'll like reference something that I'm writing from, you know, or have like a task manager over here that I'm working from, but don't want like in my main view all the time. And so I'll have that display on the side. It's like I love it. It feels so good, like fluid, like sling an app over here. And it's like, wow, it's almost like working in like a physical space where you can, you know, slide papers around and make stacks and that kind of thing. You know,
don't close stuff. You just kind of put it out of vision for a little bit and then you come back to it.
Right. Exactly. So it's going great. I also want to recommend if you're a Sonos speaker user and you have long desired to use AirPlay with your Sonos speakers and you have an always on Mac, like an iMac, for example, a new app called Audio Bridge. And I read about this app this week, saw it over the weekend. It's really great. It's like $9 to purchase, and you can try it for free for like 10 minutes to make sure it's going to work for you. But it runs in your Mac, and it's the best solution to using AirPlay on a Sonos speaker that I've seen so far. The official solution for Sonos is to use an AirPort Express, which, I mean, you shouldn't buy that anymore. They're expensive and outdated. And that's with a Play 5 speaker, which is like the $500 one, because that has an aux port. The other speakers, the lesser speakers, do not have an aux port. And so you need to also buy like this amp thing that's like $350. So it's kind of like a non-solution, unless you just happen to have that stuff around. The other solution is a free like terminal command or something that you can use. I think it's called Air Sonos, maybe. And it works like if you're technical, but I'm not as technical as you are, of course. And so like needing to download like a developer language or something, I don't know. It's over my head. And I tried it.
Even me, right, who can understand it, like having an app's just a lot nicer than doing it on the command line, really.
Sure, yeah. And so I tried the technical solution, and it has never worked for me, so I didn't bother. And this new thing is like download it, runs in your menu bar, and it instantly works on iOS and Mac OS. It's perfect for audio. Like I'm able to stream podcasts from iPhone, and I'm able to stream podcasts from iTunes on the Mac, and that's so cool because I just couldn't do that before. And you can also you can't do multi-room from iOS yet because that's AirPlay 2, and this is AirPlay 1. And eventually Sonos will do AirPlay 2, but that's maybe a year away or so. With this,
this app's like a holdover until Sonos does AirPlay 2 properly.
Exactly. But you can't do multi-room from iTunes on the Mac. So I did do, and where that's useful is I've got like stereo speakers of Sonos where you can pair them together left and right. And so for that, you need to do multi-room to pull that off. And so in my office now, I've got two Play 5s, which is like their best Sonos speakers, left and right. And from the Mac, instead of using the Sonos controller app, which is terrible on Mac OS, I've been using iTunes to play Apple Music. And it's so good. Works with podcasts too. Is not good for video like YouTube and Netflix because the lag is just too bad. And for that reason, like you wouldn't want to just use it as your system speakers either because you're going to come across video and be frustrated. But for just audio streaming, it's so cool. And I'm glad it exists.
You know, Zach, in alternative reality, you'd be using a HomePod right now.
I would be using a HomePod with AirPlay 2. I was looking back at the announcement post that mentioned some of the tvOS 11.2 features, and it mentioned AirPlay 2 by the end of the year, and that's not something we're going to see. Like, that is so obviously the reason for HomePod delay, because it's nowhere to be seen in any platform, and those releases are already out now, you know? I also want to give an update on my activity routine. You know, my on-air promise was kind of when I do this move that I'm going to take the month of December to hit my move wall every day, fill all my rings. I did December 1st. I think that was Saturday. I did some kind of exercise. I think it was I think I went for a run. Yeah, maybe I used a treadmill. I think I used a treadmill. Saturday was... I did a Sunday 5K for the first time in a long time, and I took my baby with me because I recently bought a jogging stroller, and I just went with the watch, and that was really nice. Like the jogging stroller was great. It was a beach run because of it's nearby now, and my son was super happy. Like I thought he was asleep the whole time, but when I was finished, I looked down and he was like smiling and wide awake. So that's sustainable. And then like Monday, I went on a bike ride. Finished my move ring, but didn't do the exercise ring. I was off by a few minutes, but I was tired and worried about it. And then yesterday, it all caught up with me, and I didn't finish either. But I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep going. And the thing I have to add here is that a long time ago, I signed up for a 5K plus half marathon weekend race, with the idea being like I had just finished that 10K race around April. And I wanted to train for the half marathon and like lead, you know, discuss it every week and lead up to this point. And then, you know, the summer got busy and different reasons. And I kind of actually stopped exercising. But this weekend is the half marathon. And unless someone can convince me that it's a bad idea, I'm going to go for it.
It's a bad idea.
It's probably a bad idea. But
I mean, you can do it and just stop if you get tired, like,
yeah,
if it gets too much.
Yeah. My numbers aren't crazy differently. My pace, my race pace is always faster than like my just going for a run pace, you know, according to my watch. And so that's something to go from. But I've never ran this distance before. That's 13.1 miles. But I think I'm going to go for it unless someone can, like, I don't think I can be convinced not to. So I'm going to go for it, and I'll let you know how it goes. How slow
I was. Oh, good luck.
Yeah, I'm going to be very slow. I know I will, but one of the things I'm taking into this is I will use AirPods, which gives you 5 hours. And I ran the 10K, that's 6.2 miles, and under an hour. It was like 50 minutes and something. I was really pleased by that. So my thinking was like, you know, I can do like between 2.5 and 3 hours for this half marathon. That was you know, early this summer. I might still be able to do around 3 hours. We'll see. I'll let you know. But AirPods give you 5 hours for both. But what I'm thinking about doing is wearing one AirPod at a time so that the battery life is not an issue. And then,
are you going to double it up?
Yeah, double it up. And also that's like a safety thing. It's like you're not blocking out, you know, your environment with both ears. And then also only listening to music locally on the watch, even though it has cellular and streaming, and then disable cellular so that, like, because the heart rate is going to be constantly, like, you know, on, and that'll maximize battery life on the watch and AirPods. So check back and see if I'm still around next week.
This may be the last ever edition.
Yeah.
Happy Hour Podcast.
Episode 150, it stops here unless you keep it going without me.
Well, I guess it's a nice number to end on.
Yeah, nice round number. Also in the same space, the Apple Heart study that we discussed last week, at the time, no one had been accepted that I knew. And since then, I got accepted into it. So I imagine other people have as well. Again, that's US only, like Apple Pickaxe.
There's so many US only stuff, stories at the moment, and like new features. It's so annoying.
Yeah. I mean, when HomePod comes out, like that's barely non-US.
So, yeah, at least that's Australia, UK, and US. So yeah. At least I'm in on that one. Yeah. But that one got pushed into next year, obviously. So
yeah, and so far, like from a user perspective, it's just been like further giving consent. You do like a couple of digital signatures, and then I think the only time I'm ever going to see it is whenever my heart is elevated without activity, and then it'll send you the alert. And then instead of just having the alert and nothing happening, you'll you know, it'll prompt you to maybe do the video call and you know, look into it more. So that's neat. It's cool that it runs in the background and it doesn't like bother you with anything, because the early research kit apps I looked at were all kind of involved at doing things, and that's. Without, I mean, it's bad to say, but like unless you get like a direct result from it, it's hard to keep it up, you know.
Yeah.
And this is something that you can just forget about. Just wear your watch, and you're good to go. You know.
Yeah, and I mean the thing about the heart study is that if you're perfectly healthy, you'll never get bothered by it ever again.
Right. Right.
So you should like ideally. I mean, in the best case, you're never going to see the app again. Like, if you see what I mean.
Right. Right. Yeah. And by the way, I want to tease out a story that I'm working on for 9to5 Mac. That you know. Give listeners an early you know, preview of it. But I spoke to a reader who shared his story about the Apple Watch with me. And it's a gentleman who's around 50 years old. And he had a heart attack a couple of weeks ago. And he only went to the hospital because his Apple Watch gave him an elevated heart rate alert. And he said that, you know, prior to that alert, he thought he was reasonably healthy. He's a boxer. He's a runner. He's an attorney. So his job is kind of stressful, but he thought he was otherwise healthy. He had just had a stress test done, and everything that you do when you turn 50, and every, like the doctors gave him, you know, that you're the all clear, you're healthy for your age. And then he woke up in the middle of the night a couple of Fridays ago, like 1 a.m. and had the alert from his watch that he was only wearing it for sleep tracking, which he only does like 2 or 3 nights a week. And so he thought, okay, this is actually serious. So he went to the ER, and in the ER, he told his wife, like, this is silly. This is a waste of time. Why am I here? This is, you know, what, this is just a watch, like it's silly. And then it turns out like it got worse. And the doctor told him that he had a heart attack, and that if he didn't come in that night, that he probably would have died. And,
oh my,
like talking to this man over the phone, it was incredible. Like, I mean, the number of like things that had to line up for that to happen. But like, that's a true story of the Apple Watch saving someone's life. And I asked him, I was like, you know, why did you buy the Apple Watch? Like, are you, you know, you're a boxer and a runner. Like, was this for health tracking? And he's like, no, not at all. As an attorney, he said he bought the Apple Watch, the original, like first generation one that he was still wearing, for the like productivity stuff, just to get alerts and see his calendar on his wrist because he stays busy. But not he didn't really pay attention to the health tracking stuff at all. He was using a third party app for the heart rate stuff, and so I don't think it was the new stuff, you know, the built in alert on.
Yeah, the new one doesn't work on the first generation.
Exactly, but I think he was using. I think it was the maybe the health face one. I've got it in my story. I'll have it in my notes, but it's an incredible story of just like so many coincidences of like, you know, these things all align. And the thing that he wants people to know is like, the funny thing that he said, you know, this won't be in my story, but it was interesting from the phone call. It's like, he feels like Apple advertises, you know, poop and emoji on iPhones, and that they've got a killer product that can save lives, and then they're not telling that story, you know?
Which, I mean, they do tell that story though, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. And to be fair, like he didn't buy this device that probably saved his life so that could do that. He bought it because of productivity stuff, and like it's kind of like a secret, you know, that could actually have this benefit, and that's how you get people in the door, I think, too.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Apple does, you know, drill on the hearts, on the heart, you know, on saving the life. Apple Watches save people's lives quite a lot. Like, they always promote those stories about it. They had that big video, remember, at June and stuff, yeah, when they're talking about. So they do talk about that angle, but yeah, it's kind of funny to see that next to, you know, an emoji.
Yeah.
In terms of like the impact on people's lives of a particular feature.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't just draw on the serious stuff. Like, you got to have the fun stuff too to get people in the door.
You can't be a completely serious company otherwise people get bored.
Right.
You have to have the novelty and the whimsy, yeah, and the fun.
I don't know. Did the ad from WWC like ever air on TV, or was it just like a session thing of like get people excited about developing for the watch, you know?
I didn't see it on TV, so yeah, it might have been, but it's on their website and stuff, like you could watch it online.
Sure, yeah, I didn't see it on TV either, but I, you know, definitely saw it on the keynote and online. But that's a story coming soon, maybe next week or so.
That's a cool story.
Yeah, it was so neat talking to him, and he's a really interesting person. Really not like, I mean, like, he's so sold on Apple now. I asked him if he'd ever tried other fitness trackers and everything. He said he had a Samsung phone and he used, you know, the equivalent of an Apple Watch, I guess, with the Samsung phone. And, you know, he's kind of curious about trying other things before, but now he'll never switch from Apple products because of what it is.
It's a horrible thing to happen, but you're never going to take that watch off anymore. Never.
Yeah. And I mean, like, my story of like just like getting in better shape from the Apple Watch, like I think that had like massive positive ramifications on my life. And so when I see the watch, I see it very fondly for that reason. But to know that you had like $10,000 of tests ran that said that you're healthy, but then it was like the $300 watch in your wrist that actually saved you is crazy. You know, so I can't wait to write it up. I think it's a terrific story. So keep an eye out for that. Also this week, we had some big filing news. Amazon Prime Video for Apple TV is now available, what, in over 100 countries?
That's what they said.
That's what they say. This has been something that was rumored for a while. I know Recode was, I think it was Peter Kafka that had, you know, numerous stories on this is in the works, and it's all about Amazon selling Apple TVs and Apple offering Prime Video, like the internal debate of that. They worked it out enough to have Tim Cook announce at WWDC in June that Amazon Prime Video was coming later this summer, which didn't happen. We presume before the Apple TV 4K would come out or by then, or around tvOS 11 launch. Turns out it was 11.2, a few days after that even. But I think it's pretty good how it turned out, right? Like, from what you've seen?
Yeah, it's basically a mirror copy of their TV apps from other platforms.
Yeah.
And it also supports the TV app and, like, universal search, so you can search with Siri for it and stuff. So that's, you know, it's a nice platform integration.
Mm-hmm.
They, in the press release, Apple did a press release about it. They said the app's out in time for the Grand Tour Season 2, so you can watch that on Apple TV.
That's the current version of
yeah, the Top Gear remake, went from BBC to Amazon. Yeah, and yeah, obviously that's probably one of their biggest shows. So that's kind of what they tied it into, on as if like, oh, it's finally out now because of this. But I mean, clearly something went weird that it didn't come out earlier. But
yeah, that's clever.
They did promise end of the year, and I guess it is out before the end of the year. So there you go.
Yeah, in our coverage, you were. You know, I think you had saw that it was out, and so you'd messaged me. I think it was like 5:30 my time, and I read it at 6 a.m. Like, can you check and see if it's there? And so I was waking my daughter up for pre-K, and we usually leave about half an hour later. And so we're running a little bit behind. But what happened was, you know, I verified quickly that it was there. And you could only see it not through search, but through, like, looking at Amazon's other app and then looking at, like, their related apps. But then we could see it. And then I was, like, poking around at it. And my daughter saw Barney, like, the purple dinosaur. So then we got stuck on that. She's like, I want to watch Barney now. Because we watch, like, other shows in the morning while she's getting ready. And but anyway, I think it's going to be a hit for people because there's a lot of stuff on Amazon Prime Video. And if it's cool with her in the first like 20 seconds because she found something she wants to watch, I think everyone will enjoy it.
What's pretty funny is that it also works on the third generation Apple TV, like pre-TVOS.
Yeah.
Apple TV. You can run Amazon Prime Video now.
Yeah, I've seen that box get updated channels, but I don't recall them getting new channels before like this. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, like Apple doesn't even sell this version of Apple TV anymore.
Yeah. I used to.
And it doesn't use the same like UI as the newer ones. It uses like the old TV, TV interface.
Yeah, because they had an SDK that you had to fit into, right? And
yeah, it was like very template-y back then. Mm-hmm. And now in the TVOS world, you can do whatever you want, and then they also have templates that you can use if you want, like. Quite a lot of the client apps do use templates still, then you can kind of tell they kind of like look the same and they look like the iTunes apps. But if you want to, you can skin it and theme it however you want. It's like iOS. You have the freedom of making an iPhone or iPad app. And Amazon appears to have done that here. Like it looks, they've kept their own branding, it has their own fonts. It looks almost identical to, you know, like their Roku app and stuff.
Yeah. One thing I picked up on from looking at it, it looks very dense. Like there's a lot of stuff in one view and not like you have to look all over the place for stuff. So that's kind of nice. Yeah, so Amazon Prime Video for Apple TV, finally. Alongside that launch, Apple also changed their iTunes Movies Twitter account to @AppleTV. And the first tweet was promoting Amazon Prime Video on Apple TV. And I think it's Apple TV, but I don't think the Twitter account is just for the set-top box. I think it's also like the TV app. And they call that the Apple TV app in a lot of places, even though it's just called the TV app, like on the label, you know, kind of like how the watch app used to be called Apple Watch and then they changed the label just to watch, but I guess it's like the Apple Watch app. But now they have a whole Twitter account for that.
Yeah, it is for the whole Apple TV app. So it covers content that's on the iPhone and the iPad. So it's basically, you know, it does movies and TV shows.
Yeah.
Which is, I still think calling it the TV app when it does movies is still a bit confusing. Like, because you hear TV and you immediately think TV shows, but obviously it has movies in it as well.
You can watch movies on TV at least, so.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, to me, the confusing thing is that it's
on the iPad, you won't call it a TV.
To me, the confusing thing is that the handle is @AppleTV, but it's not really about the box. It's about the app.
Yeah, I mean, we've had enough problems with TV app on Apple TV, is it an awkward name?
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting now that they're like really pushing this TV branding. Like, obviously, iTunes Movies is no more. And this is like, especially in the run-up to their original content efforts, that they're now like pushing Apple TV full stop with that icon, with that logo. Like everything you watch all in one place is like their big header photo.
Yeah,
like, they're really pushing that to the forefront.
It's like they're showing us the like Apple Music before Apple Music was a thing, you know? Like you can just imagine that this is almost the name of the service and the branding and everything. And like this is what you're going to pay $10 a month for or whatever. You know?
Yeah, and you can imagine using the TV app is where you subscribe.
Mm-hmm,
like,
sure.
You get the Apple TV subscription.
And to be fair, I mean, it's a good app. And all it needs is like good original content. I mean, it's already good for like the point of it is to unify content from various show services into one app so that you can almost forget about the home screen and just use this app to find everything.
And they have live sports now.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Through iOS 11.2 and tvOS 11.2, they added live sports. That has actual features, not just like pointing to a menu of something you can watch, but it has like sports scores and notifications. So that's neat. And, you know.
Yeah, that's still the big problem with the TV app is that it has its own queue and it has its own discovery. But when you actually go to watch the shows that aren't in iTunes, it kicks you out to a third-party application.
Sure, yeah.
Like, and that's like the last step that would make it like a fully comprehensive program is that. And also stuff like Netflix isn't there because they haven't got to deal with them.
Yeah.
But in general, the TV app has quite a lot of content providers now, including Amazon.
Yeah, it's quite good in that regard. And it works with Hulu, which is, I think, the biggest one for me. I don't think it does much in terms of the Hulu Live TV service, which I've been paying for and using. But because it works with these big catalogs, I think it's it's possible it could work with Netflix without much issue. Like, one thing I thought about was maybe profiles would be an issue, but then Hulu added profiles, and the way it works is, like, if you click on a show from the TV app, like, for example, a cartoon called Doc McStuffin that my daughter watches, it launches Hulu, but the first thing it shows you is the profile screen. So then I just select her name, and then I'm in. I could do that same thing and select my name, and I'd be in too. So I think there's an answer for all of that, and it's not a terrible a way to do it. So hopefully Netflix gets on board, because I don't see why they're not. They're already partners.
Yeah, it's definitely a policy thing rather than a technology thing. I think they just want, you know, the Netflix app to be the queue of stuff you watch. They don't want to be a dumb pipe in a different app.
Yeah, I mean, they work with search, but again, that puts you in Netflix, you know, and it almost, like, not being in that is a disadvantage. So, you know, if you search for content, you know, if it's in Netflix, it will show you that. They just don't do the queue thing, and they need to, you know, just give up. Please. Please. So, it'll be cool. Also, this is just because of the release of all those things, we've been kind of looking closer at what's been promised for tvOS this year. One thing is news integration, like live news and a news section. That's not there yet. We haven't heard why or if it's coming soon, but it's not there yet. Also, the TV app is supposed to come to more countries by the end of the year. It's come to Canada and a few other countries in September or so. It's supposed to come to Germany, Spain, and your home, the UK, by the end of the year, and it's not
there. That's what Eddie Q said at the September event.
Yeah, it seems like maybe it's not happening this year because this update's out and you don't have the TV app yet, but it could still come, just like pop up, I think.
Yeah, they still got a few days left, and I would point out that at the same event, they showed, like, one of the things that I was really happy about is that after he announced the TV app coming to those countries, he said, and we'll also have all these local content providers have apps on Apple TV at the same time, you know, so it's not just a US dominated affair. And a couple of those things on that big slide they had were logos for ITV and Channel 5, which are two of the big channels in Britain and the UK. And those apps are actually available on Apple TV now, like the ITV app came out yesterday. So maybe they're out now and then the TV app will be following in a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so. We had somebody ask us today, and it was kind of funny because we had just been discussing it, like, privately, you know. So fingers crossed. I did ask Apple and haven't heard back yet, which is not a surprise. But, you know, if we get an answer, we'll report it on Notify Mac, and we'll bring it up here. So we'll see. Also, the tvOS 11.2 update is the one that includes the new frame rate and HDR matching features. That's nice to have. If you recall, we discussed that a few weeks ago. Check our coverage for how to do that. If you have a nice TV, sometimes you can get a better experience with doing that. For me, the biggest impact was having HDR matching turned on. Things that were not HDR didn't look terrible anymore. So it's good to have. Also, I wrote a piece today on a couple of missing features from tvOS that one was promised and has no timeline for, and the other was just like a who knows when it's going to happen. But the first one is Dolby Atmos support, which is like the surround sound technology from Dolby that is, you know, more immersive than what you...
Yeah, it's a quote-unquote 3D surround sound technology that uses, you know, the same amount of speakers but fills the room more and it has better positioning of noise.
Yeah, exactly. And so... Nilay Patel at The Verge who reviewed the Apple TV 4K and asked about this, and Apple told him that it would be coming in a future update but didn't give a timeline. And so I asked today again, no answer yet, but, you know, we'll relay one if there is one, about when this will be supported. My TV does Dolby Atmos, but the Apple TV doesn't. So this is one reason I would still switch to the TV input if, you know, I want the best experience. What I'm actually doing is just not buying a Dolby Atmos speaker. You know, there's an LG sound bar that I want that does this, but I want to wait until I can use that with Apple TV. So the other thing is 4K content on YouTube. It's the same situation on the Apple TV as on, you know, iOS and macOS, which is a format disagreement with how the 4K videos are served and how Apple accepts them.
Google only serves VP9. Mm-hmm. Apple wants either the new HEVC or H.264,
yeah.
MP4.
Yeah.
And Google doesn't want to provide that. They only serve the older content in lower resolutions in that format. Their new 4K, they're only serving in VP9. So we're just kind of in like a standoff of who's gonna buckle.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because, I mean, like, there's so much 4K content on YouTube. We make it at 9to5 Mac, and there's a lot of it out there. It looks really good, and you can't watch it on the Apple TV 4K. In my situation, I can change inputs and use the built-in YouTube app and get a better experience. And that's too bad because the Apple TV is capable. It's just a policy difference that they need to
work out. there is a bit of a technological part to this in that the A11 and A10 and all those chips have like native decoding hardware chips for the older standards. So on the iPhone and the iPad, there are like battery benefits and performance benefits to using, you know, standard video formats, not having to transcode and do it in software. On the Apple TV,
it's
powerful enough and always plugged in that you could happily do VP9 without an issue, right? Like, you don't have a battery drain problem on that device.
Yeah, and on the Mac,
Apple doesn't want to, like, let the guard down on one because then they feel like it's going to open the floodgates and it'll force them to do it on the others. So that's why they're kind of holding strong. But in a pure technological standpoint, right now, they could do an Apple TV without, you know, without a problem. There's not even multitasking Apple TVs. You can't even say, oh, it's going to impact other applications. Like, you're only playing video on it.
Yeah.
One at a time.
Yeah. On the Mac, you just open up Chrome, which is, I mean, I don't like to do that, but I only do it for certain reasons, but I do it to play a 4K video at, you know, 4K resolution because they look better. I mean, come on. So I really hope that Apple, that someone makes a move here, and I wouldn't mind if it were Apple for the reason that you just discussed, because it's more in policy than anything else, you know. So, I mean, the thing is, like, on mobile, it's less important because, you know, 4K on an iPhone, you know, I'll take it, but you don't see it, right? But on...
Yeah, I mean, the resolution maxes out, doesn't it? Like,
yeah. But on an Apple TV 4K...
The max resolution of the iPhone X is 2400 by something, so you're always going to be shrunk down anyway.
Yeah, but on the Apple TV 4K, it's meant for it, and it makes a difference, so go for it. I mean, it's there, so go for it, please. But that's enough for Apple TV and tvOS. Tell me about search ads and what came this week.
Yeah, so this is an interesting development. Obviously, search ads have been out for a while. They're the blue sponsored results you get in the App Store when you search for things to varying levels of relevancy. And obviously, at the moment, developers pay per tap. So if someone searches for something and then they tap on the blue ad, regardless of where they install it, just immediately press back, they pay per tap. And it's normally like, you know, 4p up to 20p, depending on the application, how much it costs and what purchases there are and stuff like that. But you pay per tap. They've introduced a new App Store Search Ads Basic program, which is pay per install. So the ads still show, but you only pay if they're downloaded. Now, what's kind of interesting here is they pitch it as like a simpler approach and like make it more accessible to people that don't have big marketing teams. And all you can do with Search Ads Basic is set how much you want to spend per install, like the maximum, and then how much you want to spend per month. Right, so you could have a £10 budget with £1 per install. That's, you know, pretty high, but that's an example. And you could have 10 installs a month on that budget. But that's the only options you get. On the old App Store search ads, you could pick what keywords you showed up for. They'd have automatic keyword suggestions, but you didn't have to use them. You could change them around. You could change different customer demographics. But on the current App Store Basic, you don't have any of that flexibility. You literally only set budget and that's it. This is good and bad. Like, on the good side, I kind of like paper install because it gives you a better idea of, you know, what your costs are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, because you can't customize the keywords and stuff like that and the audience targeting, you're not going to really... I'm not sure it's going to be that efficient for people to spend money on it, because if the automatic algorithms that determine whether your app shows for a keyword or not are bad, then a user might, like, let's just use my app, right? Bingo machine, right? It calls bingo numbers, but you can't, like, play bingo on it. It's not like a bingo website where you can bet and stuff.
Sure.
But on the old search ads program, the automatic algorithm would make keywords that were, like, you know, play bingo, win money, for instance. That was, like, one of the search terms it came up with. Now, on the old one, you had the flexibility to disable it. On the new one, I don't have that flexibility. So I'm going to pay the money for people for that to show up when people search that. They're probably going to download it because it'd be the top result because it's, you know, sponsored and paid for to be there. But then, you know, it's not going to be what they wanted. So they're just going to delete it and I've kind of wasted my money.
And one star you.
Yeah, maybe one star maybe me, or they just go back to the App Store and I've just paid, you know, for an install, which would be a higher price than the per tap price. But, you know, it's not a genuine customer, really. Like, it was just by accident. And there doesn't seem to be any assurances that the relevancy will be higher. And I can tell you from experience, the automatic keywords on the advanced system, which is presumably the same system it's using on the basic, you just can't see it, were not particularly great. Like, there were a lot of false positives. It wasn't terrible, but, like, the bingo one's a good example. Like, it's a nuance, right? My app calls the numbers. It's not a betting app. But if I let it do the automatic thing, it would almost certainly appear for all those search terms, which I don't really want. It's like false positives I'm just paying for no reason.
Right.
So that's kind of like the trade-off. It's a clever idea, I think, to do a pay-per-install program. And they give you $100 free credit. So I'm playing around with it. It's only just come out, so I can't really give you any updates on how well it works or not. Mm-hmm. But that's my worry with it, is that I'm going to end up paying for stuff that I would never want to market those customers to.
Right. At a high level, my takeaway is that search ads are not dead. Like, they don't just roll it out and then forget about it. And also, this timing is kind of random, right? It's like not really related to anything else, except maybe there was...
Yeah, they didn't pre-announce this at WWC or anything. It's right. Just kind of... out of the blue.
Which kind of suggests, like, it's ship it when it's ready and you know, yeah, experiment as you go.
Yeah, I kind of get the feeling that the search ads business kind of just, like, works autonomously and then, oh, we show up and we add a new feature every now and then. But they don't really, like, they don't feel integrated into the general company, which is kind of, you know, they're about ads and Apple in general doesn't really like ads.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, there's good and bad parts of that. Like, you know, this if this is a good thing to have, then it could have been held until next summer, but they just put it out in the middle of December, you know, when it's ready.
Yeah, but that is my, like, thing I wanted to highlight there, is that it's a clever idea doing a paper or install option, but if they're not going to let you have the flexibility of when it shows up, I fear people are going to be paying for users that aren't actually relevant to what they want.
Yeah, you'll have to report back and see how the $300 goes.
Yeah. It'd be gone tomorrow and I got zero customers. That'd be a great experiment.
Right, okay. All right, let's also talk about Craig Federighi and Face ID.
Yeah, so we actually talked about this last week in that we were talking about how Face ID has problems, you know, differentiating between people, differentiating between siblings, and it kind of trains on the wrong account, and then you get false positives on logging in.
Mm-hmm.
And how on the Mac, you can they actually encourage you, right, to do multiple users, because you can quick user switch if you use your fingerprint. An email came in from Craig Federighi, which was a Reddit person asking about whether the iPhone X will ever support multiple profiles for logging in. So multiple faces, because obviously they never really said that Touch ID for the iPhone was meant for multiple people, but people generally use like four fingers of themselves, then, you know, a finger of their partner or their girlfriend or whatever. And he said categorically, at the moment, we're focusing Face ID on single user authentication. Touch ID's multi-finger support was never really intended for that purpose. What I wanted to flag up here is that just because it's not always intended, it was definitely done.
Yes. Like,
I don't think it was an edge case. Like, a lot of people I talk to do exactly that. They tell their partners their PIN code and they let them have a finger just because it's convenient. And on the Mac, you were going to want to add Face ID to the Mac, and definitely on the Mac, you definitely encourage people to do multiple users because you can quick user switch between them.
Yeah, it was demoed on stage as part of the MacBook Pro with Touch Bar with Touch ID. You know, it was like...
Yeah, like, you got Phil Schiller to do a demo with it, right?
Right.
And changing between the user accounts. I hope that this email is like, you know, don't expect it for the iPhone X, but maybe with an upgraded Gen 2 of Face ID with the next phone or the phone after that.
Yeah.
We can bring back at least having two people. Like, let you have two people, like yourself and then, you know, a loved one in your family. Like, it's just annoying that you can't do it at the moment.
Yeah, and I really wonder if the thing that we discussed last week, which is, you know, people that look similar, if that's part of the problem, because, like, on the, you know, as we discussed last week, if you do it on the Mac and you have siblings sharing the Mac, you might get into the wrong profile, which is problematic. On the iPhone, there's no profiles to worry about, but, you know, you still might have, you know, it doubles your chances of people looking like you unlocking your phone, I think. So, yeah, we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, and at a very high level, just because a feature wasn't intended for one thing right. Doesn't mean you should just ignore it. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's plenty of features that Apple sees that, oh, it's like emoji, right? Emoji was only ever meant to be used in Japan. And then loads of people started using it, and then they capitalized on it in later versions with its own, you know, button. They promote it. They add new emojis, a star feature of every new release. Like, just because things don't exactly work as you intended is not a good answer for why they're not there in the future.
Well,
if you could say, oh, it was only 0.01% of people did this, so we didn't think it was a big problem, you know, that's a better justification, but I don't think that was the case here.
Well, you know, like, the front-facing camera on the iPhone was intended for FaceTime. Like, that's why they put it there. That's how they marketed it. And then I don't think it was until the iPhone 5 when they used the word selfie in a keynote, like, you know, ever since selfie. And even on the iPad 2, they demonstrated it with Photo Booth for, like, fun effects and FaceTime. It wasn't, like, take a selfie, which is probably what a lot of people do with those front-facing cameras. I mean, that's the mainstream thing, you know, more than video calls, I guess. But yeah, we'll see how that goes. And then let's do a quick update on iMac Pro, status of iMac Pro. It's coming.
It's not out.
It's not out yet. Coming in December. Still no reason to believe otherwise. Apple hasn't said it's not coming in December. There are still days left in December. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, if it was delayed, I think they would have said at the same time as the HomePod. Also, you know, last month we had those photos of it being at a Final Cut Pro Summit. You know, people were tweeting those pictures of it.
Yeah.
I don't think they would be showing it off there if it wasn't actually on schedule. So
we will see.
There we go.
Yeah, it's we'll see how it goes. We'll see if it makes it, and then we'll see what shapes it's in when it does come. So iMac Pro, not delayed yet. You heard it here now.
And it'll be delayed tomorrow because that's how these things work, right?
Hopefully not. Oh, my goodness. yeah. All right. That's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. You can send us feedback. If you like the show, give us a rating on iTunes or recommend us in Overcast. I really appreciate that. I've been looking at them recently, and you know, all the feedback is terrific. I love the feedback we get on Twitter, especially. I'm going to Paul Zach there. Benjamin, you are...
BZA Mayo.
And if there's something you don't enjoy or something you want to, you know, let us know privately, you can always email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. You can read about everything we discussed in the show in the show notes in your podcast player or on 9to5mac.com. And with that, we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.